A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, fellow time travellers. Great to have you with me for another journey through space and time. As always, I like to take the time to thank all of those who have joined my Patreon community. If you don't know about Patreon, you go to patreon.com, you search for a person by name, in this instance, me, Neil Oliver, and you basically pay a little bit of money every month, or altogether for a year. And by so doing, you become part of a community, a little family. I say a little family, it's a family that's getting bigger all the time. You get access to exclusive material, an exclusive vodcast every week, competitions, various things, you know, that Paul and I are doing, and you only get them here on Patreon. I record the film here in my home in Stirling with the company of my dog. My dogs that make an appearance now and again. We run competitions and so on. It's great here. It's full of free thinkers, full of people interested in history, full of people who've got questions, full of people who are curious, people who aren't sure about what's going on and are looking for answers. So come on board, go to patreon.com, search for me by name, Neil Oliver, join the dots, become part of the family. Okay, it's now time to strap yourselves into the time machine for the next episode of my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. Wisest and justest and best, facing his fate calmly and without complaint, a cup of deadly poison placed before him. The execution of the world's most influential philosopher, devoted to the scrutiny of morality and ethics, reason, intelligence and analysis. He said an unexamined life was not worth living. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the world.
Hi Neil. In the last episode, we stood shoulder to shoulder with the legendary 300. Where are we this week?
Morning, Paul. We are staying in ancient Greece, and we're off to visit a person whose influence on philosophical thought is perhaps greater than anyone else's in the world ever. He was someone who knew how to get on the wrong side of the authorities and stay there. He knew how to rile people. And for his troubles, he was described as an irritant, a gadfly. And whatever the consequences, he was prepared to stand alone rather than say or do anything that he knew to be wrong. We're in ancient Greece again. We keep flitting in and out of certain places, Mesopotamia, Babylon, Egypt, ancient Greece. It's inevitable. It's just, if you're following the story of the world in 100 moments, ancient Greece was of significance for such a long time that we'll have to keep on popping in and out. This time, it's specifically about Socrates. One of those names. He's one of those one-named people from history, like Beyoncé, that everybody's heard of. And the theme is, I suppose, it's very pertinent. This is a story from ancient Greece. Specifically, the moment in question is 399 years BC, before the birth of Christ. But it's ever so pertinent and ever so current and contemporary, really, because it's about the importance, or let's say the impact, of being prepared to say what you think, to follow the path that comes from within, the path that your gut makes you take, and damn the consequences. There have always been people like that. There's people who keep their heads down and follow the herd. And there are people who stick their heads up and say, hang on a minute, I don't think this is right. And Socrates, effectively, he's like the patron saint, or I think of him as one of the patron saints of cussed, stubborn, defiant types that march to the beat of their own drum, as my mum always used to say. Mum always used to say, never mind what other people think, march to the beat of your own drum. It's also, and this is only just in second place, it's almost as important, it's about facing up to accepting what you don't know. I keep tricking myself into thinking that I know a wee bit about stuff, but never any more than that, just a bit. And the reality is, the only thing I really know with any kind of confidence is how much I don't know. I think when you start scratching on the surface of the sum of human knowledge and wisdom, in the little few years that any of us gets on this earth, there's barely enough time just to realise the extent, the depth of the ocean of what you don't know. So that's what Socrates means to me. We'll get to that. The moment, we might as well do the moment right at the top this time. It's the death of Socrates. The year is 399 BC, as I said, and Socrates had been convicted by a court of his peers of corrupting the youth of Athens. That's where he lived and did his stuff, Athens. So he'd been found guilty of corrupting the youth. The crime was specifically that of impiety. And he wasn't, at the same time, he was not respecting the gods. That's what they did him for. You know, the Al Capone and the Untouchables, and the police have been trying to get him for years because they know he's a criminal and a killer and a organised crime and all the rest of it, but they can't get him. And finally, they catch him for not paying his tax. This is just what they got him for. They needed to bring Socrates down, so they did. It was all a bit trumped up, really, but it wasn't really what they were angry with him about, is what I'm saying. You know, folk wanted to get Al Capone because he was a gangster, but they couldn't get him for that, so they had to get him for tax evasion. So the order came down that he was to kill himself, and he was to kill himself by drinking hemlock, or a potion made of hemlock. Hemlock's a plant, isn't it? And when you get an infusion of hemlock, it brings on paralysis, basically, that leads to death. I think what it does is basically cause a massive organ failure. I think your heart stops beating and your lungs stop, you know, breathing. It manifests itself as a slow paralysis and death. So he went for it. He gathered a group of his closest friends around him, and he drank the hemlock, and he lay down on a bed, and while they stayed around him, stayed close by, he quietly became, you know, paralysed and said his last words and died. One of the famous things about Socrates that adds to his mystery and allure is that he didn't establish a school. You know, characters like, you know, Aristotle, they established schools of thinking to which students came. He didn't do that. Neither did he write anything down. In fact, Socrates thought writing things down was a cheat. He thought that everything should be done from memory, that if you didn't actually have it in your head, you're tricking yourself into knowing something. He said you don't actually know it if you don't have it in your memory. So he didn't write anything down. And we know as much as we do about Socrates because his student, or one of his students, was Plato. You know, that holy trinity of ancient Greek philosophers that people have heard of, Socrates, Plato and Aristotle. Well, Plato was a student of Socrates, and Plato did write things down. There have even been those who have suggested that there was no such person as Socrates, which is, I think that's bunkum. But he's so mysterious and absent because he didn't leave anything tangible behind that it's even been suggested that Plato just created him. He was so important that if he didn't exist, you'd have to make him up, sort of style. And that Plato needed a character to say the clever things that he said. Plato wrote various works that are known as dialogues. And one of them, Phaedo, that's P-H-A-E-D-O, pronounced Phaedo, is the one in which Plato describes really the hours running up to Socrates' death. And according to Plato, this is Plato's account, as he was, you know, he's lying on his bed, Socrates is lying on his deathbed, and he's becoming weaker. And he says to one of his friends, Crito, that to remember to settle a debt that he owes, which is he wants Crito on his behalf to sacrifice a rooster, a male chicken, to Asclepius. And Asclepius is a mythical figure. He's the god of medicine to the Greeks. I think he was sired by Apollo. I can't really remember. But anyway, he's a mythical figure even for the ancient Greeks. God of medicine, god of health and well-being. And so, you know, Socrates is like there saying, oh, and put, you know, sacrifice a rooster to Asclepius. And Crito says, yes, I will do that. And then he says to Socrates, is there anything else you want to say? Because you know, they're looking for words of final words of wisdom, you know, a great end line. And he doesn't. He doesn't say anything more. And after a while, they pull a sheet up over his face and they leave him for a while. And then he's not moving at all. There's not even a movement. And they take the coverlet down and his eyes are staring. He's gone. And that's it. And according to Plato's dialogue called Phaedo, Crito said, and I quote, such was the end of our friend, concerning whom I may truly say that of the men of his time whom I have known, he was the wisest and justest and best. And amongst, it's a good line from Crito, but amongst other things, I like the precision of the words. And I like to think that the precision of the words comes from his having been in the presence of Socrates for long enough to call him a friend. That bit about of the men of his time whom I have known, you know, he doesn't just leave it loose. Of the men of his time, he was the wisest and justest and best. He qualifies it by saying, of the men of his time of whom I have had personal experience. There's precision there. And the Socratic method was all about asking questions and structuring the questions and the back and forth between yourself and another person until you could properly interrogate an idea and really all the time find out how much you or the other person actually knew about the subject in question. That's the Socratic method, as I understand it. Interrogating one another until you find out how much, if anything, either of you actually knows. And Socrates was, his style, whether it was tongue-in-cheek or not, was one time after another, he would find out that, you know, like in that good old line from Hollywood, nobody here knows nothing. he kept on getting, if he scraped down to the bottom of the barrel, he would find out that nobody knew anything. I don't know. I think it was certainly that was Socrates' shtick. That's what he did.
Is that, you know, that wrestling with thoughts and interrogation, is that something that, you know, gets you going?
It does. I like, it's one of those, I have a gut reaction to it. It's so, I would say, fundamental. It's a baseline. And stripped away from everything else. I suppose it's like if you found yourself washed up on a desert island with one other person, and you were stuck there, there was nobody else, you would while away the time probably by talking to each other. Because when you strip away everything else, books, the internet, everything, you're only left with what you can work out by talking to one another. And having someone else to talk to, argue with, debate with, hear their thoughts, share your thoughts with that person. When it comes right down to it, really that's all any of us have got. Everything else is a kind of a veneer. You've really only got that which is inside your own head. And also you can take advantage of the contents of somebody else's head in those circumstances. So there's something about it. There's the simplicity and the honesty of it I enjoy, because more and more, really, especially because during the last couple of years of turmoil, I've had to confront that what I thought I understood about the world I live in is wrong. And ideas that and understanding, things I've taken for granted about the world around me and the way people operate and the way authority operates, I had my head in the sand. And I've had to confront that and admit it to myself that the way I have understood many topics is incomplete at best or downright wrong at worst. And I think once you open yourself up to that, it's very liberating. I think there's a danger in having much in the way of an intellectual pride. I sometimes think that in society at the moment, some of the people most at risk of being misled and not seeing things clearly are those who think that they are very, very smart and that they know a lot and that what they know is correct. I think perversely that can make a person very vulnerable. And I've gone through a period of thinking, God, I was wrong about that. I was wrong about that. I was wrong about that as well. And it's a bit debilitating. It's a bit, it fairly brings you down, it fairly knocks you down a peg or two. And I quite like it. And it brings me back time and time again to Socrates. I definitely think Socrates really existed. And what he does, he's right in there in the bedrocks of what we call philosophy. And he marks a drawing of a line in the sand, really, of all that had gone before and all that came after. He was interested in, you know, concepts like courage and justice, piety, morality, ethics. And to better understand those concepts, he asked questions of himself. And really, the impression you get is that he wandered about Athens and he just stopped people in the street and did vox pops. You know, like a reporter, you know, you see it where they stop people in the street and ask them what they think about whatever, fox hunting or vaccines or immigrants crossing the channel. That seems to be, in a simplified form, what Socrates was all about. What do you think of? So I kind of love the idea of him. We're invited to think that Socrates embarked on what he became famous for because another of his friends, who's called Chaerephon, had gone to the oracle at Delphi and asked the oracle, who in Athens is wiser than Socrates? And the oracle had said, no one. Chaerephon came back to Socrates and said, you'll never guess. The oracle at Delphi says there's nobody in Athens that's wiser than you. And Socrates apparently then thought, oh, really? And went out and tried to find out if that was the case. And he did it by finding, well, he was doing a straw poll, but he also sought out the people that were regarded as being the wisest and the cleverest and the most learned. And he would put them to the test and he would ask them his questions and he would do his Socratic method on them, like a kind of intellectual kung fu. And he kept on finding these supposedly clever people coming up empty. For 1,000 years, anybody and Alexander the Great, all, you know, everyone consulted the Oracle at Delphi. The Oracle at Delphi was always a woman from the beginning. And legend had it that there was a temple at Delphi with the Oracle living inside it. That's where she greeted the people that came to consult the Oracle. And according to the legend, and this legend goes all the way back to the time of the Mycenaean civilization, it's an ancient idea. It was the spot on the planet where Apollo, when he was just an infant, the god Apollo, when he was just a wee lad, he encountered a giant snake, a serpent, called Python. That's why big snakes are called pythons. But this big serpent was actually called, that was its name, like the snake in Harry Potter. It was Python. And Apollo killed it. And the giant serpent's body then slipped and slithered and fell into a crevasse that they happened to be standing beside, a crack in the earth. Afterwards, vapours started to rise, and it was the stench of corruption. It was the smell of Python's body rotting. And the vapours never stopped coming, because, you know, it's a myth. You know, so the gas of the smell of Python was always rotting. And the idea grew that if you inhaled the gas, it connected you to the divine, the world of the gods, Apollo, divine wisdom. So anyone standing, breathing in this smell would be a kind of an interlocutor, a bridge between the world of the gods and our world. That legend came from all the way back in Mycenaean times. And by the 7th century BC, there was a temple there. And that whoever was in it at a time, there was only ever one oracle at a time, and that woman was called Pythia on account of Python. And it's not for the first time, and for various reasons in other contexts, it was decided that young, pure Vestal virgins, one at a time, would be the perfect conduit for divine wisdom. So it was a young woman who was installed. But nearly everybody that came to consult the oracle at Delphi tended to be a man, often a powerful man, a warrior maybe. And true or not, it seemed to be the case that often these Vestal virgins were being violated and raped by the men that came to consult them. And so to get around that, the oracle at Delphi would be an older woman, 50s, 60s, 70s, dressed in the garb of a Vestal virgin, but an older woman, so as for one reason or another she might be at less risk from the guys that were coming in. And by the time of Chaerephon and Socrates, the deal was that the oracle at Delphi would be available to meet people for one day in each of the 9 warmest months of the year. So 9 days in the year you could go to the oracle at Delphi. The idea was that Apollo, I don't know, went on holiday in the cold months, just wasn't around, so you couldn't consult the oracle because he wasn't there to communicate with. And funnily enough, the excavation of the site of the temple at Delphi in the 80s established a subsurface, a deep down the earth crack, or a couple of cracks, from which, because of the nature, the bitumen content of the rocks way down deep, there may have been a release of methane gas, right enough, seeping up in this location. And if you intensified that by building a temple, a small, don't think big, don't think, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral, a little windowless chamber on top of this, that would fill up with methane, and it's possible that a person sitting in there would begin to get a bit, whoa, trance-like. So that there may have been an actual geophysical explanation for what seemed to happen to people in the temple at Delphi. Others have suggested it was snake venom, you know, linking back to snakes, python, serpents. And of course, there's always been the supposition that people were just acting, that it was just a performance that was put on. Confusingly for us, people who would go to consult the oracle at Delphi were called consultants. They wanted to consult the oracle, so they were called consultants. And of course, we think of going to see a consultant, you know, a consultant heart surgeon or a consultant psychiatrist or whatever. And so if you went on one of the 9 days that she was available, you'd either stand in line, and you can imagine queues, because hypothetically anyone could come and ask, consult the oracle at Delphi. But as is always the way, you could fast track it, like getting through security at the airport, if you paid. So powerful people would come and offer money. And that was how the temple at Delphi became rich. Because it was, you know, there was cash coming from kings and emperors and others who would come, and they would jump the queue by offering up money. Whoever came, you'd also have to provide an animal sacrifice, you know, a chicken or whatever else you could afford. Maybe if you brought a bull, you'd be more inclined to get a more interesting answer for your question. And over time, the oracle at Delphi, the genius of the oracle at Delphi was that the answers she gave, and the answers either came directly from the oracle, or sometimes the oracle at Delphi would speak in tongues, an incomprehensible babble, and there'd be a priest nearby who would interpret. You don't understand what she's saying, but I do, and here's what she just said. But the genius, however it was being done, however the answer was being acquired, was that the answer worked multiple ways. You know the magic eight ball? You know that black magic eight ball that you shake? You ask it a question, and then you shake it, and the answer you get, it always sort of fits. You can make that answer work. Well, the oracle at Delphi was a bit of an ancient Greek magic eight ball. And there was a famous example, Croesus. You know Riches Croesus, that saying? Croesus was the king of Lydia. And Croesus was thinking about going to war, attacking Persia. God love him. And before he did it, in ancient times, nobody of note did anything without consulting the oracle at Delphi. You just didn't. You didn't move. Didn't make a move. And so Croesus came, no doubt paid a great sum of money, got in front of the oracle at Delphi and said, what will happen if I attack Persia? And the answer came back, an empire will fall. And Croesus took that as a good omen. Thought, fantastic, it's going to be the end of Persia. But he was defeated, in fact. It was his empire that fell. But there was no way that anybody could go back and say, well, your answer was wrong. Because all she said in answer to the question was, an empire shall fall. And it did. So the fame and the wisdom of the Oracle at Delphi came on and on and on. So anyway, that's a bit of a detour. As I said, Chaerephon told Socrates what the Oracle at Delphi had said, and he then went out there doing his thing, asking questions. And after a period of time of applying his Socratic method, Socrates came to the conclusion that none of the smartest people that he encountered seemed to know anything, or not anything that he valued. And he decided that, he said, well, even before this started, I already knew that I didn't know anything. And because I at least knew that I didn't know anything, that actually does, as it turns out, make me the wisest man in Athens, just as the oracle had said. And the thinking goes that because so many people, high-profile brains, had been bested by, maybe even humiliated by Socrates in front of other people, there may have been a growing feeling of animosity towards him, you know, because nobody likes a smart arse, as the saying goes. In terms of background, what we do know about him is that he was the son of a stonemason and a midwife. He, in his younger days, had been a very brave soldier. He'd taken part in the Peloponnesian War, which is the war after we've dealt with Thermopylae, where Athens and Sparta joined forces to defeat Persia. After that, Athens and Sparta fell out big time with one another and went to war. That's the Peloponnesian War. And Sparta won it, ultimately. It went on for years, not on forever, but eventually the Spartans were victorious. And Socrates lived right in a time where Athens was in chaos, really, because Athens had always had very high opinion of itself. It certainly looked down on Sparta. And it was a very difficult adjustment for Athens to come to terms with the fact that they'd been wholly defeated by anyone, never mind Sparta. Socrates lived in that time of tumult and anxiety. There had been a battle in the year 406 BC, part of the Peloponnesian War, called Arginusae. I'm not sure how you pronounce that one. Athens had won the battle. It was a battle at sea. It was a battle between galleys, ships. But although the Athenians had triumphed, there had been a storm in the aftermath of the victory, and 25 Athenian ships had been lost. And the men, all the crewmen, hundreds of them, had been left to drown. So it had been something of a Pyrrhic victory, in as much as Athens had triumphed, but at great cost. And there was what amounted to an official inquiry in the aftermath, and six of the generals were put on trial. Six of the Athenian generals were put on trial. And the public mood of the demos, you know, as in democracy, the public mood of the people surrounding the trial was that they were out for blood. They wanted these generals punished. And Socrates, the way the system worked, it was a bit like a jury and a chairman of the jury taking care of the trial, overseeing the trial. And Socrates, by lot, really, just because it was his turn, effectively, he was the president of the assembly, as they called it, that was in charge of the trial, that was conducting the trial. And the mood of the mood was convict. But Socrates wouldn't and didn't. He wouldn't convict the generals. And in the aftermath of that, which was very controversial, Plato, again, because we only know what we know because Plato wrote these things down, Plato said that Socrates emerged as a gadfly. A gadfly is an insect that bothers horses and bulls, bites them and, you know, makes them angry, annoys them, makes them, you know, snort and flick their tail and everything. So Plato said that Socrates emerged as a gadfly who was liable to and had the confidence to defy the majority, to stand up in the face of the mob, the demos, the establishment, whatever, and just say what he believed. And he was prepared to take the consequences of doing that. It wasn't the only time that he did that. That wasn't the only occasion. After the Peloponnesian War, Sparta won, and Sparta put in place a kind of a puppet government to run, to oversee the rule of Athens. And it was comprised of 30 pro-Sparta leaders, and they were known as the 30 Tyrants. And on one occasion, Socrates defied them as well. He got up in their faces and challenged them. And so that's the kind of individual we're dealing with. And so, in short, he changed philosophy. Prior to, I'm no philosopher, but prior to Socrates, there was a belief amongst the smart Aleks that you could understand the cosmos, you could understand the universe and everything that surrounds it by intuition. If you just thought enough about a subject, you would come up with the answer. That sounds pretty cocky, really, if you think about it. You know, I don't need to read a book or go anywhere or look at anything. I can just think. I can just think up the answer. But Socrates concluded, I mean, he was by no means a scientist or anything. He wasn't establishing what we understand as the scientific method. But he did at least conclude that you should look around and ask questions. You know, so he was foundational in as much as he thought he didn't know enough. Before him, those that self-described philosophers thought they were so clever, they could just work everything out, just with my brain. But he didn't think like that. He thought, I don't know anything. And the only way I'm going to improve my understanding of everything is to ask questions. You know, I mentioned before, all of this was happening while Athens was going through a great deal of upheaval. And I suppose it was probably a time where a lot of people, with any sense, you might say, were keeping their heads down because there was trouble looking for somewhere to go. But Socrates, in that atmosphere, put his head up. And by so doing, he was implicitly challenging the wisdom of the majority. He was challenging the wisdom of the demos. And by so doing, he became a kind of a useful scapegoat for anyone, the great and the good, who wanted to distract people from all that was going on. All the hardship, a lot of people had lost everything. Times were hard. Does that sound familiar? Because it should, because as far as I'm concerned, the powers that be at the moment are trying to distract us from cost of lockdown crises and all the rest of it. And, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And that was the period of history in Athens that Socrates lived through. And he became this useful scapegoat, someone they could go for. Let's just distract everyone by going after this guy that we could do with taking down anyway. So, bit of a show trial. They accused him of disrespecting the gods, of corrupting the youth. But in reality, what they were probably out to get him for was he was challenging the rule of majority. He was really saying we should actually take our direction from cleverer people, philosopher kings, people who were a combination of rulership and great wisdom, philosopher kings, that you didn't need a majority of them. You wanted to be directed by people who had demonstrated that they really were clever, and that they had demonstrated that they were clever, not because of where they were born or who they were born from or anything else. It had been made plain because of the things they could think and the things they could say when put under pressure in the context of an argument. So they convicted him. They got him anyway. You know, he made all these... apparently, it was during his trial that he said he's probably his most famous line of all, which is, an unexamined life is not worth living. That was part of his defence of himself. And the thinking is that the court, although they convicted him and sentenced him to death, they probably would have been satisfied if he had just kind of accepted his cancelling. Because that's what we're dealing with here. Socrates was being cancelled. He was being deplatformed. And it's highly likely that what they really wanted him to do was off. Just go away. Leave Athens, never to return. But he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. Socrates told his friends, and Plato wrote it down, that he could hear a voice inside his head. Now, that's not to say that he thought he was mad, but the voice inside his head didn't tell him what to do, it told him what not to do. And he listened to it all his life. It told him, don't do this. So the implicit message from the court was, go away, shut up, stop doing what you're doing, naff off. But he wouldn't do it. And instead, he was 70. Well, he was an old man by any standards, really, and certainly by the standards of ancient Greece. And maybe that played into it, but he decided to stay put and drink the hemlock and die because he was defiant to the end. And those last words about the rooster, when he says to Crito, don't forget to sacrifice a rooster to Asclepius, he may well have been acknowledging a deep understanding that he had come to, that the times through which he was living needed a sacrifice. Athens was a muddied, polluted mess, and it needed to be cleansed, purified, cured in the way that a god of medicine might do, Asclepius. And his dying words may actually have been Socrates suggesting that he was offering himself up as the necessary sacrifice. He was that rooster. But in any event, 399 BC, Socrates, when he didn't necessarily need to, accepted death rather than any other alternative. And he stands head and shoulders above many, many others in the herd, because he's one of those few. There have always been a few, at least, who won't back down, who won't shut up even when told to do so, and will continue to ask questions and say what they think and march to the beat of their own drum, regardless of the consequences. That's Socrates. Strength in numbers and cooperation. A league of states is formed, throwing off the Persian yoke. Jealousy and conflict simmer amongst allies. War lifts its devastating head. The mighty Spartan hoplites take on the rich and powerful Athenians. Intrigue and double dealing. The tectonic plates of power shift as democracy, politics, philosophy, and art flower like never before. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new and exclusive history and comment vodcasts every week, sign up to my Neil Oliver Patreon site. It would be great to see you there. Check out the Instagram account called Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is simply called the Neil Oliver Channel. And to help build this podcast, please tell your friends about it, get them listening, and perhaps write a review to convince the online crowd to join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Fat Belly Films. Music is composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar, CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucy and Archie and Teddy. Finances by Catherine and Trudy. The post-production is by Althorp Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been an FBF Podcasts production. Hey, Gracie, how you doing? How you doing, big girl?
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.